This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another 30 with Murdy. I hinted at you last week. We've got some special things coming up in season two, and that includes this week when I welcome my first Hall of Famer to the podcast. It's Cal Ripken Jr. He certainly needs no introduction, but I'll give him one anyway. Baseball's Iron Man, the Magic Knight in Baltimore 1995, when he played in his 2,131st consecutive game and broke Lou Gehrig's unbreakable record. Cal tacked 500 more games onto that mark before taking a breather in September 98, a Sunday night game that was against the Yankees. Rookie of the Year in 1982, World Series champion in 83, elected to the Hall of Fame easily on the first ballot in 2007. Ripken's a Baltimore lifer, born and raised. We talked a little about his growing up there and about specific moments of his two biggest baseball achievements, catching the final out of that 1983 World Series and the night of 21-31. Among the other subjects I asked Cal about, I asked what he admires in the current crop of young shortstops, about his son Ryan Ripken, who recently signed a minor league deal with the Orioles. And from the guy who played every day for 16 years, we hear his thoughts on the recent NBA controversy of resting star players. Cal's also an advisor to Commissioner Rob Manfred on youth programs, and we talk about ideas for the future of the game at the major league and youth levels. Some interesting ideas here for sure. Finally, we discuss his career in writing children's books. His latest is called The Closer, and it's now available from Disney Hyperion Books. I taped this interview with Cal last week when the Yankees were in Baltimore, originally scheduled to be done at his office outside of Baltimore. A change in my travel plans forced us to do this over the phone, but it's a fun conversation. It was fun for me, and I felt like it was kind of fun for him too. So here you go. Cal Ripken Jr. spends 30 with Murdy. I'm guessing it's going to be a little harder for you since you grew up around the game, but I wonder what you can tell me about the first baseball game you ever went to. Do you have an early memory of going to the park?
I wish I had sort of a Billy Crystal moment where, he walks out and he smells the grass and it's the coolest thing in the world. I grew up around baseball and I grew up around the minor leagues. And my experience when we went into different ballparks were similar to those sort of feelings that you kind of walked up and then all of a sudden when you looked out the ramp, the field was exposed to you. And I had a chance to go out and run on them and play on it and see how nice the grass was and those sorts of things. Or how in the minor leagues, how not nice the grass was.
Yeah.
But it was, I always just loved the, and I still get a sense of peace when you go out and see a ballpark or you're sitting at the ballpark. I went to opening day this year, hadn't been there in a while, sat in my front row seats, and it was a really comfortable scenario to be in, just being there with the grass and dirt, just a few feet away.
I talked to Mark Shapiro last year. I know you know pretty well, kind of growing up. And one of the things he told me that was kind of cool is because of what his dad did, players used to come over to his house, and it was just kind of normal. Do you have some memories like that where that was the case?
Just hanging around the guys in the minor leagues and the guys that came through. I mean, early on, you can almost remember Jim Palmer played for my dad. Mm-hmm. Mark Belanger was on that with the team out there. I was really young. But a lot of the names that went on to the big leagues and you looked at, you knew that you were hanging around them, that you had some sort of relationship with them before they got to the big league. So that was pretty cool. Mark Shapiro, you mentioned him a minute ago, being at the Hall of Fame, I think, for Brooksy's induction.
Mm-hmm.
Hanging around, Mark at that time and David at that time, I think they were both at Brooksy's induction.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of hanging around time and going through the museum. I never had that experience really to go through the museum. And just kind of walking through and looking at all the things at the museum, that was a really cool experience. You would think that being around baseball that I would have had a chance to go through that Hall of Fame. But when I think of you know, the Shapiros. I kind of remember that moment Wow. where they were pretty wide-eyed, and I was wide-eyed at the same time, and I was a big leaguer.
It's funny, like, as baseball fans who go to the Hall of Fame, you know, we get wide-eyed at certain things. What are the things that you remember that struck you?
I just remember my dad didn't throw away anything, so he had his catcher's gloves and different fungos and different bats that were made over the years. So seeing a catcher's glove with no break, you know, I knew about those sort of things. Yeah. But going back and looking at the equipment and seeing the size of the equipment or what was there as the game evolved and developed, I thought that was really interesting. Even the uniforms, the styles of the uniforms, some of the – I really like the different – ballpark dimensions and how long they used to be, and sometimes hedges were as part of the fence, and the bullpens were inside, you know, the field, flagpoles were inside the field, you know, all those yeah. seeing examples of those things I really like, you know, from a design element, but it really gives you a flavor of how they took a field and made it their own. It was very difficult to hit a home run yeah. to any part of the ballparks except straightaway left and straightaway right.
I know you've obviously got a few artifacts there that people can go up and see. And one of the neat things that they display up there is, you know, stuff from every World Series champion. And I know you've talked about that being, you know, one of your fondest memories, if not the fondest of playing, is winning a championship in your second year. Wasn't so fond for me. I was a 13-year-old Phillies fan watching at the time. But yeah, I joke with Ken Singleton a lot when I see him. I say, you know that ring you're wearing? You made a kid cry when you won that, so I hope it's worth it.
it made a lot of us happy, though.
I'm sure it did.
I still consider myself a kid at that time. I think I was 20, yeah. 83, late in the year, so I was just turned 23.
So only 10 years different. The thing I want to know from you, Cal, I've had a chance to talk to different people who've had a chance to make the final out. And you got that chance, Gary Maddox, line drive for the final out in Game 5 and the celebrations on. I wonder, in your mind, can you still feel the moment? Can you see the ball coming to you? Can you feel it in your glove? Are there certain things that stand out about that moment that everybody dreams of that you got, but it only lasts for a couple of seconds? Do you still feel it?
Absolutely, you still feel it. As you were describing it, the line drive, I kept thinking in my head, it was a little humpback line drive. When it first came off the bat, I thought I was going to have to jump for it. And I remember the anticipation of, you know, we're at a point where there's the last out. And I didn't think, well, maybe a ground ball is coming to me or maybe the ball is coming to me. You just got ready in any way. But you knew you were one out away from a world championship, and it was inevitable. We had a 5-0 lead, and we felt like it was going to happen. And so I just remember the excitement. And I haven't been really a part of a no-hitter mm-hmm. from one pitcher, per se, where you're playing defense. But as the game, you know, I remember Palmer had a no-hitter deep into the eighth. I think Messina had a perfect game going into the ninth, I think. And so there was a couple times when it was broken up at that point. But you started to get an anticipation of those last outs. That feeling is like 10 times that much in in the World Series. You're sitting there. This is everything you worked for. So when Scotty McGregor threw a pitch that got in on him a little bit, and the line drive came out, it was a, you know, sort of a jam, a little bit of a humpback jam line drive. And when it left the bat, it looked like it was a little high and I was going to have to jump. And as I realized, I read the ball and it was coming down to me, it was an easy play right at me. Mm-hmm. And you just reach your glove out and catch it. And then, you know, the feeling of satisfaction when you close your glove around the ball. You knew you had the ball and you're running in to celebrate. I remember at that time there were still people that charged the field.
Yeah.
So somebody was trying to grab the ball out of my glove, I think, and then somebody tried to grab my hat, and then you're trying to hold on, secure your stuff and celebrate at the same time. And then it was a quick exit off the field since you're in the way, and the celebration happened up underneath. But yeah, catching that ball, it wasn't a hard play, but it was a play that you remember really clearly your whole career from the significance of what it meant when you caught it.
There's the other moment, obviously, and we're going to get to a few more things with you, Cal, but the other moment that obviously that everybody, I'm sure, walks up to you and talks to you about all the time is 21-31, and they all have their own memories. I have some of mine watching, you know, from the studio I was working in at the time. But I'm curious if there's one significant picture in your mind from that night that that the rest of us didn't see that sticks out to you, that when you think about that night, it's one of the first things that pops up in your head, and it's not something that the rest of us maybe saw that night?
Yeah, and I might have said it a couple times, but I mean, I'm sitting in my office now, and I got a big picture of my dad over my desk. Mm-hmm. It was a pencil drawing that was given to me by the Orioles. I mean, it's fantastic, really realistic and live. So that the moment I had with my dad, there were some people that thought my dad might not come back, you know, for the for that night. And I'm pretty sure that I knew he was, but I didn't really talk to him about it. And he was sitting up in the skybox, kind of to stay away from the action a little bit. And when I came out, I can't remember how many different times I came out to say thank you, because the applause kept going on, and it was in the middle of the game. But I remember looking up to him and pointing at him. Mm-hmm. And there was about 1,000 kind of words that kind of went back and forth between us and our eyes, I still get goosebumps, you know, going down my back when I start to think about that moment. So that's one I haven't talked a whole lot about. Of course, you get a chance to celebrate with your little family and in the whole California Angels dugout. Everybody came down, and I had a chance to meet and embrace every one of them. Mm-hmm. And I remember, hugging Rod Carew, and I kind of went away, and I went, "That was cool." So those kind of moments, they were all the way around. And of course, the lap around the field when Bobby Bowe and Rafael Palmeiro told me in the dugout that I had to go do it, and I'm going, "I'm not doing that." And then when I went back out, they came out of the dugout and physically pushed me down that direction. That was the start of a pretty special trip around the stadium. And one that no one could have choreographed, or no one could have predicted how that would come out and how that would play out. I was a little embarrassed at first, mm-hmm. and once I started to get into it, it didn't matter to me anymore whether the game was going to start or not. It was just a wonderful human experience. So I guess when I look at my whole career, those two moments we talked about, the World Series moment and that one, mm-hmm. they're two different feelings on a baseball field. One is much more of a human moment, and one is sort of a professional feeling, fulfilling a dream. As a kid, wanted to be a big league player, but you also wanted to win the World Series. And by grabbing that last out, that gave me, you know, the most unbelievable feeling. But 21-31 was pretty cool.
Because you're a guy who was known for going to work every day, playing every day, I'm curious what your thoughts are on one of these latest sports controversies surrounding the NBA, where they have not just regular players getting arrested, they have star players sitting out for not an injury-related reason, and it's being strategically done by coaches, and it's caused a little bit of an uproar, as I'm sure you found out. What's your take on legitimate stars that paying fans are coming to see in real regular season games, not even suiting up for the game?
Well, I mean, there's some data that there's a bigger part of the season. Baseball players in 162 game schedule playing every single day. An everyday player wasn't necessarily 162. That was sort of defined maybe as 150, 155. And so they were getting strategic days off, and because of travel. I mean, it's a grueling physical schedule playing every day, and it's also maybe more mentally challenging. I never thought that I would get a blow or I'd feel so much better if I missed one game. Mm-hmm. I can see the logic of you going in this slump and you're 0-25, and you played a 15-inning game last night and you got Roger Clemens on the mound the next day. It might give you a mental lift by sitting down and watching somebody else play. Mm-hmm. I never looked at it that way. But I can see the logic of, you're trying to win the championship and you're trying to rest your pitchers, you're trying to, you know, rest your regular players and give them a blow at times. So I can see the logic from a fan standpoint. You know, you want to go to the game and watch these players. You know, if you're buying a ticket and you want to go, you want to see LeBron. And then to not see LeBron in a game that you went to, it almost feels unfair to you. I will tell you, when I had back surgery and then towards the end of my career, the Sunday day game after the night game, it was harder to recover, you know, being really stiff. And so I missed a number of Sunday games, you know, from the day game after a night game. It was because I knew that if I didn't, you know, give myself a chance to recover, that it would get worse and worse and worse, and then maybe it would result in me missing a lot of games. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I remember people telling me, "Yeah, I came for, you know, 3 hours, I drove 3 hours, and you didn't even play."
Yeah,
And I said, well, where were you for the other 17 years? So it, I understand the disappointment of people that go to the ballpark or go to a basketball game to wanting to watch you know, the players that they went to see. And it doesn't feel right to me. I don't have an answer for it. Mm-hmm. I understand both sides, but I was someone that wanted to grind through it, and I didn't see the benefit of sitting out a game. I thought some of my best games were when I felt a little down, and that I could contribute. And as Dad used to say, you can't worry about yesterday's game, you can't replay it, and you can't play tomorrow's game until it gets here. You might as well play today.
Good philosophy.
That's how I always looked at it.
I was curious, getting back to your game, the one you're more familiar with, there are a lot of good shortstops out there. As the season has started, you know, watched what Francisco Lindor did in the opening week. Carlos Correa, I know, has been a guy that you've pointed out. What do you think of this current group, maybe compared to some of the groups that have come up together along the way? It seems they come in bunches. Are there favorites for you here as you're watching? Maybe Javi Baez, you saw last year. Are there any of these guys that stick out to you that you're impressed watching?
Yeah, I mean, all the fantastic shortstops. I mean, it seems like it's a celebration of the shortstop right now. I mean, Addison Russell was really impressive watching him, and I didn't get a chance to see him much. And Francisco Lindor, I had a chance to cover them in two series last year, and had a chance to sit and talk to him. And then Jimmy Rollins and I went out and talked to him a little bit about shortstop as a segment for TBS. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really impressed me is you can look from a distance and watch the physical skill that Lindor has, and he might have the best range of anybody that is out there right now. It seems like his first step, he's fast, he's quick, he's long in some ways in his steps. He just seems like there's no ball that he can't get a shot at. And but listening to him think about the position, and then thinking about the risk of you know, making certain plays, or you know, the flashiness. He wasn't worried about. He has a flashy style, but he's not worried about making plays that make him look flashy. He's looking about the risk in making the plays. And I loved him even talking within the shifts. He was talking about moving, you know, with situational counts within the shift. Mm. And that's exactly something that I would think about doing. I always had to position myself because I didn't have his legs and his range. Mm-hmm. But here's a guy that has his legs and his range, and he's making minute adjustments in his position within, you know, what they're putting him in the shift. He has the leeway to do that. So he has a really good understanding of the position. So I really liked getting to know him a little bit. Seager out in L.A.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, he's a thick, big kid. So, I mean, you look at guys that are 6'4", like Correa, you know, is really a little bit more slight at his he's strong as anything. But you look at Seager's got a little bit more weight on him. He moves exceptionally well, but he makes the position at shortstop look pretty easy. But he's a big guy. And so I enjoy watching all the different types of shortstops, but in particular the guys that I can relate to, the guys that, mm-hmm. you know, backhand the ball and set their feet before they throw, because that's how they have to, you know, like I had to. And so seeing them have success at the position really makes me happy.
The nuances of the shift that you talked about, could you see yourself being a guy who would have been comfortable playing on the other side of the bag as many times as some of these guys are asked to do?
No, I mean, no. To answer it quite honestly, I think you had to have a really good reason, you know, and that you could prove to play somebody that far in the shift. Mm-hmm. And I know that they have data that supports that, but the situation and the pitcher's matchups and things change. And I think the hard part right now is for those that really advocate, you know, the positioning. And even though you start to see the extreme shifting go away a little bit, because I think maybe it's proving that it's not as effective. Mm-hmm. But if you want to try to prove that it is effective, that you have to compare where the shift you played and then compare to where you would have played. And there's not just one position that you would have played if you didn't play the shift. You following what I'm saying?
Yes,
so if you can compare it to a straightaway position, say, okay, we shift over here and we took these hits away from Teixeira. But if we wouldn't have played him that far over, we would have played him straight away and we wouldn't have been able to get to these balls. But my point is, if we're playing Teixeira, sometimes you can play him more to pull in a count that's favorable to him. Sometimes you play him a little bit less. Sometimes when he's hitting really well, you know, he stays on the ball more, and he's more apt to hit a ball, you know, to the shortstop side. I used to always think about Reggie Jackson that way.
Okay.
If Reggie Jackson was swinging really well, I couldn't play him as extreme to pull as I did normally. But if he was struggling, he seemed to roll over the ball and kind of get out. He was much more of a pull hitter. So knowing how he was swinging the bat gave me sort of an indication, and knowing how he matched up against each individual pitcher changed how I played him. So I guess I'm not an advocate of saying there's one way to play one guy. I like the freedom and the flexibility to move within the count and how he was swinging the bat.
Very interesting stuff. I want to shift over to your fatherly side, because I see that your son Ryan signed a minor league deal with the Orioles, has struggled a couple of years in the national system, and is now with the Orioles. Less from the baseball side, Cal, more from the side of being a dad. What's it like to watch your son chase this dream and not have a lot of success? You obviously have the baseball background to deal with that side of it and maybe instruct him a little bit or get him through. But just as a father who's watching his son struggle, what's that like?
Yeah, well, I mean, Ryan's career is pretty interesting. I mean, he's got good potential, and he was drafted on his potential. He's got good size. I mean, he's 6'6", he's 240, and he looks skinny. You know, so he has easy power, but he hasn't, you know, really shown that. And starting out with his career, he hurt his ankle. And so he missed some time because his ankle, they rehabbed his ankle, and they came back, and they thought that was the better route to go. And then he re-injured his ankle again, which required surgery. So when I look at his early development, he didn't have enough time to really get his, literally get his feet on the ground. And so he missed a couple of years. And then when you miss a couple of years, people get drafted in the system. The system doesn't stop. First basemen keep coming in. And I guess he found himself with other people passing him in that system. And so you get into a numbers game sometimes. So I recognized that that was the case, and he didn't have a whole lot. The Nationals didn't have a whole lot to grab onto, but they choose to play the players that they want to play. Ryan's really happy that he has a second chance here with the Orioles. The Orioles see the potential that he has, and he needs to get at bats. So he's had glimpses of times when he faced a lefty slinging guy that throws 95. And he's a left-handed hitter, and he hits a ball off the wall where he stays in there, and he has a good at-bat. So he's capable of hitting the guys that throw really hard, and he's capable of hitting the guys in between. It's just a matter of learning. So I think for him personally, he feels like physically he's sound for the first time, you know, being a professional. And mentally, he feels really good right now. And I think he just wants an opportunity with both those faculties, you know, to see if I can do it or not. And so I can't teach him how to hit, you know, a guy that throws really hard or a guy with a breaking ball. You have to go to the plate and have at-bats. And in my own development, I thought it took me almost 1,000 at-bats before I knew myself. You know, and thinking about 1,000 at-bats, it's like 2.5, maybe 3 seasons. I did it because I went to Instruction League and I went to winter ball, so I accelerated the process of those 1,000 at-bats. But learning how to hit somebody that throws hard, learning how to hit somebody that throws a breaking ball, hit outside, inside, you need to face those guys. And I think that's what Ryan's looking for, an opportunity now, just to prove to himself whether he can do it or not.
Do you find yourself just being the dad, hey, everything's going to be okay, or is it a lot of the type of baseball things that you've just been talking about?
Well, I mean, there's a reality of what I know and what I've seen. And the reality of, you know, you can't hide from your stats.
Yeah.
Now, in the end, it's not all about the stats. You know, it took me a year. My first season, I didn't hit a home run, and half the season into my next season, I didn't hit a home run.
Yeah.
And I had some pretty decent size. So it's not all about the stats that tell the whole story, but stats do give you a measure of your success. And so you can't hide from that. So you're going to have to go out and do it. So the reality of baseball is pretty clear, and he knows about that. But as a dad, reassuring him, you know, staying positive, you know, working, doing things you can control. I just want him to know if he can do it or not. And, you know, so if he didn't get a second chance with the Orioles and that was it, you know, with the Nationals, he would wonder whether he could do it or not.
Yeah.
And so I think he still has the potential, and he's just looking for the opportunity to see if he could do it.
Well, if he's when he's in the New York Penn League, if he's up this way, needs a place to stay, give me a call, because you know it's we're pretty close to a couple of the stadiums up here, so I can help you out.
Chance to play there with all Auburn last year. And went through the that league. I think he's looking for to get himself rolling in a in the extended spring training here, get himself swinging the bat good, and then hopefully, you know, the season the other season doesn't start until middle of June.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's hoping to find a chance to play before that.
I guess he lucked out because he got to be in the same organization and teammates with Mariano Rivera, where you had to actually face Mariano Rivera.
Yeah, there's a couple of kids of former players that are around, and I always cringe a little bit because the expectations for the kids are because of what the years the father had, and they should really have a chance to be their own person.
Definitely.
So I think sometimes they don't get that chance, and it puts a little added pressure on them. They need to develop almost a little bit in quiet so mm-hmm. they can really find out who they are, but they've been dealing with it for years, and so they had each other to lean on, which I think is really good. And they have the courage to go out and try it.
Your role with Rob Manfred is special advisor on youth programs. One of the things I read that you said that I thought was very interesting, when you talk about experimenting at the youth level to move the game along. Obviously, pace of play is the subject that really keeps coming up in baseball. I'm curious what you think baseball is going to look like in 10 years. Maybe not the things that you're kind of talking about right now, or maybe the things that you are. What do you think it's going to look like 10 years from now to the generation that we're trying to reach?
Well, I'm hoping the game itself doesn't change. You know, even thinking about deciding extra inning games, the format of what they do in the Olympics or what they did in the WBC, mm-hmm. that's crazy to me. I want the rules to stay the same, and I want the same opportunities. But I do agree, when you're appealing to the younger kids, you want to get to the action ball a little quicker. You want to create, and really you're teaching situations. So it's not bad to create a game at the younger level where you do change the counts. Maybe you start with a 1-1 count. Maybe you start with a 2-2 count. Maybe a 3-2. And because now the action pitch occurs much quicker, and maybe you put runners on base in each one of your innings. So you start off with a guy on first. You start off with a guy with first and second. So the infield and the defense, these sort of concepts have been born out of showcase camps, where people are looking at and trying to put them in situations so they can see them perform.
Okay.
So they're creating situations. I'm a big advocate of that at the younger level, to actually make a game out of it and say, okay, here are the rules of the game, and this is the situation you put them in, and you get kids that are able to run the bases and do things that are really important. But when it comes to actually competing and playing the game at the highest, or when you start to get in, the game is a really good game, and understanding, you know, what happens, you know, in some of the slower moments. I will say the pitcher controls the pace of the game.
Yeah.
Any great pitcher throws strikes, gets ahead, the hitter has to react to that, infielders are ready, the game sort of moves under the control of the pitcher, I think. So that's an important element.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, pitchers seem to go 0-2 to 3-2 a lot.
Yeah.
And instead of knowing how to get them out, effectively and save your pitches. When I look at that, I think pace of plays, game clocks, and things like that that help move the game along, and kind of can, and maybe even, I never like stalling in the game of baseball. So mm-hmm. if you don't have a pitcher ready, and all of a sudden you see the manager sometimes tell the third baseman, go out there and talk to him, and then if he comes back and then tells the catcher, you go out and talk to him, you know, I don't like that. I think you're getting caught in a situation where you're, I remember Joe Girardi a couple times in his career as a catcher, all of a sudden mysteriously got something caught in his eye. and the trainer would have to come out and take something out of his eye, and in the meantime, the guy in the bullpen now is ready.
Yeah.
And so I don't like that. And so maybe you control some of the visits to the mound in a way. Maybe you only give so many meetings that occur. But beyond that, I see if you start to teach the pace of the game in the minor leagues a little bit more. If you put a clock in the minor leagues, mm-hmm. you're starting to have them understand that there's a pace of the game that you want. But at the big league level, I think it should just unfold.
So, yeah, it's kind of more like the idea that once a lot of things have been born that way, Cal. When you start things in the minors and get people used to it, by the time they get to the big leagues, it doesn't have to be enforced as much. It's just kind of born in them, right?
Yeah, I like that concept. I like the educational concept of teaching situations and getting the game moving and appealing to kids. Minor leagues, I like showing them, you know, that playing the game is also professionally, there's sort of a pace and there's an expectation. And then you don't have to enforce it when it gets to the big league. That's just, it's their second nature, and they know that's how the game is presented.
Your latest book came out last month, The Closer. You've written, I think, six of them with Kevin Coward from Disney Hyperion Books. What do you like about presenting these kids' books?
It's Kevin Coward's really good at bringing characters to life and bringing the dialogue between the kids. I like the concept of that book was to be able to deal with some social issues or some issues that teams deal with in a way that doesn't seem like it's critical. So you're just telling a story about things that happen. You know, the very first one was really important to me. Was about a hothead. Mm-hmm. It was about basically me losing your temper. And so many kids deal with what do they do with the temper, and so many parents deal with how to deal with it. So you have that issue that comes out in the form of a team, and you show them, you know, from a coaching standpoint, from a parent standpoint, and also from your own individual learning, you know, what that looks like and how you deal with that. And so it was a way to deal with the one of them was the supersized slugger, mm-hmm. the kid that was a little overweight. Some of the stigmas that happen with that, even though he's very athletic, you know, what happens with that, and even bullying issues.
Yeah.
So issues that are normal to kids, if you can read a story or you can look at it and relate to it that way and kind of understand that there are ways to get out of it, even as simple as being able to share that with your parents.
Yeah.
You know, many kids feel like they can't, you know, share that with their parents. And this was a way to say, here's a way that this ball player handle it. You know, maybe there's something in here that can help you. I really liked dealing with those issues in the context of a team.
I love the titles. The Closer is the latest one. You had Hothead, which you mentioned, Squeeze Play, Out at Home, Wild Pitch, Supersized Slugger. I've got one for you next one. Are you ready for this one?
Okay, what's the next one?
This Play is Under Review.
This Play is Under Review.
Like that one?
Yeah, the instant replay. I'm a big advocate of that.
Yeah.
I tell you what, I don't know if I want to say this or not, but I will.
Okay.
I used to think that, you know, the improvements of the electronics in the game, you know, whether the home plate umpire could ever be replaced with technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to think that, yes, that he could be replaced. When I start to look at how games can switch, you know, you look at playoff games, one pitch that goes 1-1, the count goes to 1-2, it's a critical time
when
the base is loaded. And so a missed call at the wrong time, or even if you look at the game, sometimes you look, well, God, that strike zone is not as good for this team as it is for the other team. It makes you wonder a little bit how that game was impacted. So if you had some sort of electronic strike zone, other sports are starting to use that, you know, really effectively. And so turning your back on the technology might not be the way to go. But it feels like it's moving in that direction. And it's quite possible it could make it, you know, a better game, you know, to find out who's the best team.
Brian Kenny is going to love you just for saying that, and I'm going to make sure I point it out to him.
My brother Billy has a good time with Brian Kenny, going back and forth on some of the things up at MLB Network. So I've gotten to know Brian Kenny a lot more through Billy.
Yeah.
than I did when I was hanging around him.
It's funny because you mentioned the counts. I've always thought it's a pretty simple concept as far as I'm concerned, but I always thought if you just went back to calling a rule book strike letters to knees, it would change everything about the game that we want to. It would get better counts, which leads to more action pitches and improves the pace of play. The uniformity is one thing, but I think if you opened it up a little bit more, what you're talking about, every 2-1 count would become a 1-2 count and get to the action quicker.
Well, I have a different feeling of that. Some people's theories, if you open up the strike zone, you move the game quicker.
Mm-hmm.
I see the opposite. I think, once, especially at the big league level, if you widen out the strike zone and you give a pitcher out there saying, oh, you called that a strike and it was off the plate, I don't have to throw the ball over the plate, and I'm going to see how far you go out.
Mm.
And so I think the counter is probably more effective. If you have a tighter strike zone and the pitcher knows that he can't fall around, he's got to come at you, then the hitter knows he's going to swing earlier in the count and the game will move. But I'm an advocate if the home plate is designed as that's how far the plate goes, the width of it. If you want, if you don't think the strike zone's big enough, then change the size of the plate. And even the up and down pitch, I thought that you know, if you're calling the higher pitch or you go from the letters to the knees, you can hit that those pitches. Mm-hmm. They're hard to hit a really good fastball that's up around the letters.
Yes,
but if you're calling a pitch off the plate outside, no hitter can get to that one. And if you try to get to that one, you're cutting off yourself on the inside corner. So I like the idea of having a strike zone that's represented by the plate. And, you know, the up and down part doesn't bother me nearly as much as expanding the strike zone in or out.
Well, seeing as how you have a few thousand more at-bats than I do, I will defer to you and your judgment on that one. Listen, thank you very much for the time, Cal. I hope we get a chance to do it again down the road.
I'd love to. Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
This was the first chance I've really had to chat with Cal Ripken Jr. He retired after the 2001 season. That was my first as a beat reporter. We've crossed paths only a couple times when he's been in the broadcast booth with TBS. I've worked with his brother, Billy Ripken, over at MLB Network and know him a little bit, but I really enjoyed this talk with Cal, and I feel like he did too. It was actually kind of cool to hear him talk about a couple of things like the 83 World Series or the night of 21-31 that he's probably been asked about a million times, but he still gave me thoughtful and detailed answers. We're off now to a good start in Season 2, I think, so go back and check out my chat with Greg Nettles if you missed that one. Working on a special project that should be posting next month. I'll have more details on that coming up. And come on back next week for another, hopefully, entertaining edition of 30 with Murdy. Thanks for listening.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.